for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. We've been having a couple of technical difficulties, and I seem to have lost my script, so bear with me for just a second while I find it.
Chuck, today we'll be welcoming back regular guests Julius Alafong from Cameroon, Michael Hayes from Denver, and Karen Kitkowski from Mount Vernon, Mount Jackson, Virginia. Also Phil Ferruccio from Fort Orange, Florida. And as always, I'm up here in Duluth, near Duluth, west of Duluth. And Chuck is in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And we're looking forward to being able to visit with those guests tonight. The weather report from Duluth, it's fair to partly cloudy, I would say. Weather report from Fort Lauderdale, I can guess it's sunny and 78.
That's about right, Mike. Okay, well, all the thing that I wrote for myself to start is gone, but here we go anyway. I found the lyrics, so we're starting off with a song about greed. I've been thinking how to talk about greed. I've been thinking how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed, trying to find a way to talk about greed. Greed is a poison rising in this land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops. Its work is never done. A creeping, killing, choking, invading everywhere. There's really no escaping greed's tricky snare. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. It has you buying anything and spending out of control. Not partial to gender or your sexual desires. All it wants is you to want to own, possess, and buy. Greed is a strain in the American dream. Having more than you need is the essential theme. Everybody wanting more than they need to survive. It's a perfect indication greed has settled inside. Maybe you don't really know exactly what I mean. You don't really want to know about your and my greed. You may wonder whether you're infected by greed. If you have to ask, then this song you really need. Greed is sneaky and hard to detect in myself. It shows itself clearly in everybody else. I can see it in you. You can see it in me. We can see it in big corporations, throughout the government. See it in the banks. I can see it in the military. See it in church. I can see it in my neighbor. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. Been thinking about how to talk about greed. Been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Gimme, 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 gimme. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show. We're broadcasting live, just like we do every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And I'm proud now to turn the show over to Mike Palachek, my friend and co-host.
Well, Chuck, tonight, as I said, we welcome back special guests Julius Alafong, Michael Annis, Karen Kitkowski, and Phil Ferruccio. So tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Duluth, Minnesota, Port Orange, Florida, Mount Jackson, Virginia, Denver, Colorado, and wherever you are. We continue with our miniseries regarding A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America. It's a book. The culmination of all this is Jim Fetcher and Kevin Barrett in the False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio every Thursday. They are the evolved media. We know that today's newspapers, radio, and TV are garbage, as well as the current version of what passes for alternative media, The Nation, The Progressive, NPR, Alternate, Rachel Maddow, Justin Raimondo, Seymour Hersh, David Swanson, Amy Goodman, Jon Stewart, if not garbage, at least suspicious, very suspicious. But what we want to do is to say something in this mini-series here about the history of the alternative press, the beginnings that have evolved into Fetcher and Barrett. More from the book by David Armstrong. If the Catholic Worker supplied 60s activists with moral guidelines, I.F. Stone's Weekly, 1953 to 1971, provided them with a model of conscientious reporting. A defrocked daily journalist who had worked for The Nation and several defunct liberal dailies, Stone wrote and researched well-documented reports of official duplicity drawn directly from published government documents. A libertarian in the classic mold, Stone strongly criticized Joseph McCarthy at a time when the nation's broadcasters and major newspapers seemed mesmerized by the red-baiting senator from Wisconsin. In later years, Stone scolded J. Edgar Hoover's then sacrosanct FBI for failing to protect the civil rights of blacks, chipped away at Cold War foreign policy, and supplied intellectual ammunition to the anti-war movement. Almost alone among the nation's Washington reporters, Stone criticized the 64 Gulf of Tonkin resolution as a fraud and a sly maneuver to commit U.S. military forces to Vietnam. In 1955, 2 years after Stone started his weekly, the triumvirate of Dan Wolf, Ed Fancher, and Norman Mailer started New York's weekly Village Voice, launched as a vehicle for stylish personal writing and Democratic Party reform politics. The Voice quickly attracted a following for its coverage of the Greenwich Village arts scene. The Voice, liberal rather than radical, always traditionally owned and operated, was a problematic model for the underground press, but it was an influential one nevertheless. Its style and wit were much admired by underground press pioneers such as Art Kunkin, who modeled the Los Angeles Free Press on The Voice. The Free Press never matched The Voice's literary quality, but with its extensive coverage of radical politics and the Los Angeles cultural scene, it echoed The Voice's conscious appeal to a community of interest. From A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America, continuing next week.
This message brought to you by The Boogeyman. The United States of America has a huge military and hundreds of bases around the world that people were told for 50 years were needed exclusively to counter one enemy, communism. And now there aren't any communists anymore. The CIA needed to be so huge to counter the KGB. But now there isn't any KGB anymore. The FBI needed to be so huge because the Reds were everywhere, even under our beds. But there aren't any Reds anymore. So we don't need the military and bases and CIA and FBI, right? Yes, but no. They're terrorists everywhere. They attacked us on 9/11. And they're big bees from Mexico. And so there you go. We still need almost all your money. It is what it is. Have a nice day. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. And please believe what we tell you.
Dude, hey. We're talking about unchecked aggression here. Forget it. You're out of your element. These freaking amateurs. I'm talking about drawing a line in the sand. Has the whole world gone crazy? Remember Pearl Harbor. Yes, remember Pearl Harbor. Tattoo it on your forehead. They bombed your freaking harbor base.
They bombed your freaking harbor base.
That really tied the fleet together. Am I wrong? So, my man, how may I help you?
Listen, let's get something straight here. You're the man. I'm the people. So that's what you call me, or El Gente, or Vox Populi, if you're not into the whole brevity thing. very complicated case. You know, a lot of ins, a lot of outs, a lot of what have yous.
What in God's name are you blathering about?
I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I got new information, man. New crap has come to light. Man, he bombed himself. Roosevelt, FDR, Pearl Harbor, to get the United States into World War II. It happens all the time, man. Gulf of Tonkin, sinking of the Maine, Operation Northwoods. Oh, it's a very complicated case, man. And, a lot of strands to keep in my head, man. A lot of strands in the old people's head. Oklahoma City, Waco, 9/11, Wellstone.
You want a tow? I can get you a tow. Obviously, you're not a golfer.
JFK.
Mark it zero. I am the walrus.
RFK.
Mark it zero. I'm the walrus.
MLK.
The bum's lost.
Well, that's just like your opinion, man.
The bums will always lose. Your revolution is over. Condolences. My advice is to do what your parents did. Get a job. Forget about it.
Over the line.
Mark it zero.
Mark it eight, man. Or you're entering a world of pain. This is not Canada. This is Bowling Green, man. There are rules. Mark it eight.
There. Are you happy now, you crazy nut? F it. Hey, forget about Pearl Harbor. Let's go bowling.
That base really tied the fleet together.
Your name's Lebowski, Lebowski.
After leaving the Washington Post in 1977, Carl Bernstein spent 6 months looking at the relationship of the CIA and the press. His 25,000-word cover story was published in Rolling Stone on October 20, 1977. Just saying. The Paul Harvey School for Advanced Neo-Journalism Studies at Columbia University has announced a new area of study. Well, not new, just that it's now in the catalogs. The school, located in New York City, is a large gray stone edifice, lots of trees, sidewalks, bicycle parking spots. Instructors going in and out wear long robes and wizard hats. Hogwarts School said to have been modeled after Paul Harvey School. The stately sign on the front lawn reads, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false." William Casey, CIA director. The CIA owns everyone of any significance in the major American media. William Colby, CIA director. The school is an affiliate of the Paul Harvey Memorial Concentration Camp for the Journalistically Insane. Past guest instructors include Alan Dulles, Frank Wisner, Cass Sunstein, Rush Limbaugh, Bob Woodward, William Buckley, Peter Matheson. Past holders of the prestigious Joseph Goebbels Chair include Rachel Maddow, John Stewart, Walter Cronkite, Anderson Cooper, Bill O'Reilly, and Matt Rothschild. The Emmanuel Goldstein Chair for, but don't quote me on that, is held posthumously by Penn Jones Jr. and Philip Graham. Gary Webb, Hunter Thompson, Bill Hicks, and Michael Hastings are buried in the front yard next to several blank headstones and vacant plots that read simply, "This space available." The Jennings-Brokaw Rather wing of the school shows detailed wax scenes depicting the careers of these famous American CIA reporters. Well, anywho, the Paul Harvey School for Advanced Neo-Journalism Studies at Columbia University has announced a new area of study. Well, not new, just that it's now in the catalogs. The old journalism baseline used to be who, what, when, where, why, and how. The Paul Harvey School for Advanced Neo-Journalism Studies at Columbia is now revising that standard and passing it on along to the other major schools. The new standard will be WWGSWST. What would the government say if we said that? Has Langley vetted this? Did the Pentagon okay this? the Paul Harvey School for Advanced Neo-Journalism Studies at Columbia University. Seek truth and report it.
Our first guest of the night is Julius Alafong. Julius Alafong comes to us from Cameroon, and we are very lucky and pleased to be able to hear his commentary every night.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Mike, for having me on the show. I want to, in this presentation, distinguish between two types of Boko Haram, what I call the hard power Boko Haram and the soft power Boko Haram. In my past presentations, I have been talking about the hard power Boko Haram. First of all, let us recall the history of the birth of the hard power Boko Haram led by Abubakar Shekau. Shekau's Boko Haram in Nigeria began as a social problem, where students of the University of Maiduguri demanded for better studying conditions, including the reduction of tuition and other expenses. Maiduguri is found in the northern section of Nigeria, a section characterized by indescribable poverty and underdevelopment. It should be noted that this northern region, just like the northern region of Cameroon, is mostly inhabited by the Hausa, with a majority of them being Muslims. This poverty and underdevelopment is partly and primordially due to bad governance and bad management of the country's resources. With such poverty and a denial to listen to the plight of these students, they resorted to a more aggressive form of demand, which today has become the destructive, or what I call hard power Boko Haram. It should be reminded that these students only wanted to be better educated in order to live well and uplift their country. Coming back to Cameroon, let me recount an anecdote. Recently, in the northwest region of Cameroon, a social problem broke out pitting the Mbororo, or the Peul community, against the Catholic Church. In fact, the chief of a local community in a village called Banja sold to the Catholic Church a portion of land that belonged to the Mbororo community. Their houses were bulldozed, and they were all chased out of their land. This problem became politicized when the young Mbororo men went to the governor and told him that if their land is not recovered and their houses not rebuilt, they will become the Boko Harams of Cameroon. Instantly, the problem was solved. Now, let me come back to what I call hard power and soft power versions of Boko Haram. The ideology Boko Haram is in the Hausa language. Loosely translated to English would mean Western education is forbidden. Let's analyze the term forbidden. We can say something is forbidden because it is considered bad and counterproductive, or evil, sinful, or demonic, if we use the religious connotation. From this definition of Boko Haram, that is, Western education is evil, Western education is forbidden, Western education is bad, the question which I seek to answer in this presentation is, are the men of Abubakar Shekau the only people to promote this ideology? In other words, is the rejection of the Western education only practiced by Boko Haram extremists? My argument here is that Boko Haram, or the Boko Haram ideology, meaning Western education is evil or is bad or is counterproductive, is equally promoted by some government officials of some African states, that is, through their actions, through their behavior. And from this, I want to make a distinction between Shekau's Boko Haram, or hard power Boko Haram, as I put it, and the governmental Boko Haram, or what I call the soft power Boko Haram. The concept of soft and hard power are coined by the international relations scholar Joseph Nye. By soft power, I understand a subtle but conquering force, which could be transmitted through behavior, culture, tradition, language, diplomacy, and some people talk of hegemony. And these are means to dominate others. Hard power Boko Haram, or hard power as promoted by this international relations scholar, could mean the use of physical and cruel force, especially the military and war. So, if Shekau Boko Haram means Western education is evil, then, after rationally observing the manner in which some of our governments handle the concept of governance, I can with certainty interpret their actions as carrying ingredients that equally promote the ideology of, in quote, Western education is counterproductive or bad or evil. Why do I say so? Or what are the elements that can be used to support my argument? Alexander Krumel says this, and I quote, "Africa lies slow and wretched. She is the maimed and crippled arm of humanity. Her great powers are wasted. Her condition in every point calls for succor or help," end of quote. After Africa, anyway, despite its abundant resources, raw material, and human resources, is still one of the continents where people live as though they are on a barren land, where governments behave as though those whom they govern have no feelings and brains, and above all, as animals being led to a slaughterhouse. Some of these ingredients could also be found in the willingness of some leaders to perpetuate power by all cost. The promotion of neo-patrimonialism, the criminalization of the state, mismanagement of resources, unaccountability and lack of transparency, nepotism, and even lack of patriotism. This is observed through their willing or their will to cling as long as they can to power, even going against the basic precepts of democracy. Maturin Hognipo, another writer, says this, and I quote, "Some African rulers struggled for many years to retain power at any cost, and they denied civil liberties. Even peasants without voice or power are suppressed and destroyed to prevent their being mobilized to demand reforms," end of quote. Some scholars hold that when a leader stays in power for so long, he ends up being bound to confuse the properties of the state to his private property, what we call, or what political scientists term, neo-patrimonialism. Neo-patrimonialism is a new form of patrimonialism. What is patrimonialism? Patrimonialism used to be practiced by feudal German kings over their fiefdoms, and this disappeared with the formation of the state in Europe, or the modern state in Europe. The German sociologist Max Weber denounced patrimonialism through his ideal type model of bureaucracy in modern states. With the advent of modern state in Africa, some leaders, especially those who stay in power for long, tend to confuse what belongs to them and the state property. What belongs to them, or what belongs to the state, to their private property. We can also talk of the French political scientist Jean-François Bayard, who wrote on the criminalization of the state in Africa. In fact, that's the title of his book, The Criminalization of the State in Africa. In this book, he talks of national resources of some African state being plundered through organized groups, and this organized group are constituted of government officials. Bayer shows how African states have become vehicles for organized crimes, specialized in covering up corrupt practices of those in power. Even the legislative, the judiciary, and the executive organs, which are supposed to be independent to one another, as promoted by John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, are far from being so, because the head of the executive indirectly controls the other two organs. We can mention the lack of accountability and transparency in the management of state resources. Consequently, those who are supposed to be wealthy, that is, the investors, find themselves being impoverished or competing wealth with civil servants and other government officials who are out or who are in government to serve the state and promote general interest. When people illicitly amass for themselves, social problems increase, as the state is unable to fulfill its basic social responsibilities because its coffers are empty. Empty because they are embezzled, mismanaged. So when education, which is the most important symbolic element in the consolidation of the state, is not taken seriously, when actions taken are not in conformity with the reality on the field, when peripheries are abandoned because governments have decided to promote what Jean-Francois Bayard in his book calls the politics of the belly, we simply observe a subtle denial or rejection of Western education, or the refusal to apply the essence of Western education. That is what I call soft power Boko Haram. And this is what gives a leeway to the formation and construction of the hard power Boko Haram. Feelings of unhappiness develops when people feel, when people don't feel belonging, when social cohesion is absent, when access to fundamental rights as well as to political, economic, and social cultural benefit is limited only to a clique. This leads to the rise in some rebellious attitude, and the vulnerable population will be easily recruited into carrying out acts that are counterproductive. Hegel looks at these frustrated people. I mean, Hegel, the philosopher, looks at these frustrated people as people who are, as he quote, a degree inferior in civilization. Of course, they are. They are inferior in civilization just as those who push them to behave the way they do. People who are therefore not integrated in the state are viable weapons for the promoters of hard power Boko Haram. So, I will end here by saying that there equally exists a governmental Boko Haram, what I call soft power Boko Haram, and which in turn is the main cause of the hard power Boko Haram led by Abubakar Shekau. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to expatiate on my research. See you next month. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Julius Awafong from Cameroon. We are extremely fortunate to have this learned student of political science as our man on the ground in Africa. I'm sure we get a very different viewpoint than what we might have seen from over on this side of the pond. Thanks again.
Now, to honor America, please stand. Every one of you out there, washing your car, sitting on the toilet, polishing your coin collection, driving in your cars, kneeling in the confessional, please stand. And to honor the coming war with Iran, please remove your hat. To honor the coming shock and awe, the awesome slaughter of a whole new batch of brownish people with high-tech weapons paid for by single mothers with 9 jobs, dropping off their children at daycare at 5 a.m, please remove your shoes. To honor those journalists on our televisions, inside our radios, and in our newspapers who work diligently each day to bring us the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, please remove your shirt. And now, ladies and gentlemen, to honor the wise and discerning and courageous leaders of our nation who will lead us in this coming slaughter of babies, infants, toddlers, young adults, mothers, fathers, and old people, please remove your pants, your dresses, your underwear. And at this time, please turn to the gigantic American flag rippling in the breeze at the north end of the stadium. Turn around and bend over and repeat after me. F the FBI, F the CIA, F the NSA. I'm living in the mother effing USA. And now introducing a new book that I'm involved in. Chuck and I are both involved in it. It's called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either. It's from the press release. The Beatles, the Holocaust, and Other Mass Illusions, authored by Jim Fetzer, cover design and artwork by Ole Domegaard, edited by Mike Pelichek. Unlike the government, none of us have any reason to lie. Some might say this may be the most dangerous book in the world, and they might just be right. The book demonstrates with scientific argument and empirical proof that man did not go to the moon, that Paul McCartney was replaced after his death in 1966 and that the official narrative of the Holocaust cannot be sustained. It also explains how and why the U.S. hung one of his doubles, not the real Saddam Hussein, and that Osama bin Laden was not killed by U.S. Navy SEALs in Pakistan in 2011, but died from his medical conditions in 2001, where it was politically expedient for him to die a second time. The book is called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either. It's published by Moon Rock Books, excuse me. It's available at Amazon.com and also at CreateSpace. Also, a federal jury has sentenced alleged Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev to death. Here is an editorial comment from New American Dream opinion guy Hunter S. Flintstone. How many lies of enormous magnitude are the American people expected to accept from their government and the mass media? The evidence for concluding that this was a drill using amputee actors and special effects filming is overwhelming, where neither Tamerlan nor Dzhokhar Tsarnaev were responsible for the explosions or events thereafter. The mass media insults our intelligence. How, for example, could Dzhokhar have run over his brother after Tamerlan had been arrested by the police? The proofs that Dzhokhar did not do it are so blatant and numerous that they should be intelligible even to reporters for the New York Times. That the Times should be ignoring the evidence and promoting a fantasy defies belief, unless, of course, it remains under the control of the CIA. Here are several proofs that make the case. We have a video with a soundtrack that shows the police using bullhorns to announce, "This is a drill. This is a drill." Listen to it for yourself. If the Boston police knew it was a drill, how could the Boston Police Commissioner claim they were guilty and even had additional explosives they were planning to use? Why is he lying to Chris Wallace on Fox News? We have tweets from the Boston Globe that a controlled explosion is going to be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities, and another stating that one would be set off in front of the library in 1 minute. When the Globe knows it was a drill, why has the Globe, one of our nation's premier papers, not spoken out about it? The alternative media had already zeroed in on the perps the very day of the event itself. Who were Kraft International personnel wearing khaki trousers, black jackets, and black baseball caps with the skull insignia where the motto of Kraft is, "Violence does solve problems"? When amateurs using computers can solve the problem, why can't professionals? We have photos of two Kraft personnel, one of whom was wearing a black backpack with a white square in it, where the backpack that blows up is black with a white square in it, and of the two of them running away from the location as the bomb it contains explodes. This is about as obvious as it could possibly be. Now you see it, now you don't. Immediately after one of the explosions, there is no blood, which Lorraine Day, MD, Chief of Orthopedic Surgery at San Francisco General Hospital, with 25 years of experience, has observed would be impossible if this had been a real event. There would instantaneously have been blood everywhere. According to reports from the AP, such as the Huffington Post, three persons, including one child, were killed and 260 injured. It has become part of the official narrative about the Boston event. But the images from the scene suggest a number closer to 20. Where are the other 240 victims? When the blood finally shows up, it is fake blood, special effects, Hollywood blood, which is not even the right color. And when the scene clears, the tubes from which it had come can be seen. If this had been a bona fide bombing, it would not have been necessary to fake it. They faked it because it was only a staged bombing, which produces no blood, not a real one. A perfect example of the use of actors turns out to be Nicole Branagh-Gross, who, although feigning to have had both legs broken in two places and had her Achilles tendon severed, sits calmly, displaying no agony or pain, in striking contrast with professional athletes who are used to enduring pain, who grimace and contort from injuries far milder than what she claims. The Tsarnaev brothers, who were under surveillance for at least 5 years, were selected as patsies because of their country of origin. But they were actually ordinary young men, where Tamerlan had a wife and a child and was considering moving to New York, while Dzhokhar was a college student who participated in wrestling and was popular with his fellow students on campus, where he went after the bombing. Perhaps the most bizarre of all, Tamerlan was arrested, stripped naked, and placed into a police car which was widely broadcast at the time. His mother and his aunt confirmed his identity. According to the absurd official narrative, moreover, Tamerlan was killed by Shokar, who drove over him repeatedly in an SUV after his police apprehension. In an appalling act of treachery, the FBI sent a five-man team to interrogate a friend of the two Tsarnaev brothers, Ibrahim Todashev, 27, who was concerned that they were coming to kill him. Apparently, after lengthy but unsuccessful attempts to persuade him to turn against his friends, all left the room but one, who shot him multiple times, claiming he had violently attacked him. According to the Boston Police, the FBI, the Boston Globe, Fox News, and every other major media outlet, the Tsarnaev brothers were responsible for the Boston bombing, even though we know it was a drill, that no one died, and it was done by Kraft International personnel. Even the Boston Police Commissioner and the New York Times support the fabrication in spite of the evidence against it. The latest absurdity is the bloody confession of Shokar Tsarnaev recovered from the inside of the boat, which is nevertheless written in perfectly straight lines, which are evenly spaced, an achievement that not even Leonardo da Vinci could have accomplished. This is a Photoshop creation by projecting a two-dimensional image to appear to be a three-dimensional one. We are being deceived on every count about Boston, about Sandy Hook, about Ukraine, about Iran, about ISIS, and more, to advance a political agenda run by elites, including the Khazarian Mafia, through a covert government where the CIA serves as their instrument, which even Bill Clinton, as president, admitted he did not control. Americans are the least informed and most gullible population on earth. We confuse authority with truth when the truth should be our authority. Even our newspaper of record, the New York Times, entrusted to chronicle the official history of the United States, plays the public for fools. Unless we know the truth, we cannot act in our own best interest because we don't know what those actions would be. This is not a nation that deserves respect. It is a sham, a fraud, and a disgrace to all who perceive the truth.
At the end of the day, remember that this day was brought to you by Operation Northwoods Spray Deodorant. With Operation Northwoods, the fog hangs in the air long after you're gone. Back a few decades ago, some people in government planned to carry out murders and crash airplanes and have fake news reports to fool the American people into invading Cuba. It didn't happen only because John F. Kennedy, a real president, was in office. But then the ones who liked the idea of Operation Northwoods killed Kennedy, and now we have fake everything. Fake presidents, fake news, and fake wars. Oh, the killing and dying are real. It's just that everything else is baloney. Operation Northwoods, it hangs in the air. I'm an American. I've lived all my life here, gone to high school, college, sent out resumes. I have a general knowledge and converse fluidly on many subjects, including the history of TV, dramas, situation comedies, game shows, and reality shows. But I can't breathe. I've worked, gone to school, produced a family. I've watched all the big national events on television. I can talk about them all during a variety of social gatherings. I read, I listen, I watch the news on TV, but I can't breathe. I am an American, free, brave, courageous, giving, creative. I yearn for more, but I can't breathe. I think there might be more. I want more. I read some writers and hear some things that make me suspect that all I see within my peripheral vision and hearing and touch from my lounge chair is not all there is. I'm young and idealistic, and I have a great, amazing life to live. But I can't breathe.
Our next guest of the evening is Karen Kitkowski. Karen visits with us each month from Mount Jackson, Virginia. She is a retired military person. She was in the Pentagon the day that 9/11 happened. She is a retired lieutenant colonel, I believe, in the Air Force. She also ran for Congress. She also comments regularly on newrockwell.com. And she used to have her own radio show. I don't think she does that anymore. In any case, Chuck will be attempting to get Karen on the phone right about now.
Well, you know, Mike, I've been having trouble getting hold of Karen. I've tried several times all day, and I think maybe she's not available tonight. I did happen to pull up one of her articles from LouRockwell.com, and I think maybe I'll read that.
Sounds good, Chuck.
This is called Enjoy the Decline and Fall of American Statism. It was published on LouRockwell.com this past March 13th. The headlines at Drudge are an excellent barometer of what's up with government and culture. Glancing over cops being killed by the other side of law enforcement, the people, Hillary's new Whitewater files, this time electronic, Army and Secret Service partying, drug use, and sex rings. The predictable result of partial legalization of pot, neighborhood informers. We find a report that confidence in government is lower than ever. What? Well, the poll taken in 2014 looked at consumer and investor faith in the product, i.e., the president, judiciary, legislative, as well as mainstream media, banks, big business, organized labor, organized religion, education, medicine, and the scientific community. We are government consumers and investors in these products, although we have little choice. The massive unitary state, this lock-stepping, integrated, wealth-consuming, constantly expanding Rube Goldberg machine is what we, the people, have bought, and we feed it daily. We're afraid not to, lest it fall down in a million pieces and smash us. The poll designers were either extremely naive or extremely perspicacious. They've cogently asked how we like our fascism, sunny side up or easy over? Not surprising. The people indicated they prefer to skip breakfast due to a growing queasiness in the pit of their stomachs and a sense that something's going to fall on our heads. The poll indicates that we are disgusted by government media, government legislation, and 15 straight years of dictatorship. We have no faith in the justice system and organized religion, and are discontent with the corporate state of big business, big medicine, big education, and big science is seething. All good signs, of course, that change is coming. Our identity as U.S. citizen is becoming something we'd rather not talk about. This is how all empires collapse. And the one led by Washington, D.C. is not special. Unlike all the children in Lake Wobegon, we are beginning to recognize our child in D.C. is not above average or exceptional. Rather, he's a pretty nasty devil who's never going to make something of himself. Maybe it's the weather, or Snowden, or independent media, or our empty bank accounts. At some point, hard facts around us inspire calls from the crowd of, "Why, the emperor isn't wearing anything. He's buck naked and butt ugly, too." Each day brings more lies from government, military, intelligence apparatus, law enforcement, big banking, big business, big pharma, Common Core and the whole global warming conglomerate. With each revealed lie, each uncovered fantasy of our overlords, each example of our two-track injustice system, faith is lost and anger grows. We who are interested, curious, or invested in living a free life watch the headlines and their subcurrents closely. Anarcho-capitalism, for me and for millions of people around the world, is the most logical and reliable theory of human liberty and its antithesis, the parasitic and sin-oriented state, which is to say, the state. Anarcho-capitalism informs us, and on a day like today and every day, shines a happy light on the headlines. Like this one. Bomb-sniffing elephants? Not so nutty, U.S. Army says. At first glance, the title instantly brought to mind the image of a modern-day and slightly Bollywood Slim Pickens gripping a nuclear missile between his legs, holding onto his cowboy hat. I thought of what this could mean for domestic air travel in the U.S. with elephants installed in airports supervised by legions of TSA agents checking in the passengers. And the U.S. Air Force demanding hundreds of billions of new spending on elephant-suitable transportation. I could see a refreshed and powerful relationship growing between PETA, the wildlife, and organic poo crowds. Bolstered by the Agenda 21 crowd that hates traveling humans anyway, and the military-industrial complex that lives to serve. Of course, American farmers would need new subsidies to raise elephants for the military, to provide retirement homes for the old ones who've lost their sense of smell, or, knowing an elephant, probably just faking it to get their Social Security. This could be a real shot in the arm for a military-industrial welfare state that's lost public support for foreign wars and titanic waste. Of course, the Democrats would be angry because of the undue lobbying for elephants everywhere and all the potential photo ops, and we'd surely need to subsidize an equal number of donkeys. 14th Amendment would certainly come into play here. The Air Force would need hundreds of millions more for separate donkey transportation as well, and at this point, Amtrak would offer, at the price of major new subsidies, separate train cars at vast savings to the taxpayer, of course. For the sake of the innocent animals, both proposals would receive full federal funding. In a new age of bipartisanship, elephants, donkeys, and state capitalism. Oh, my. But, upon reading the article, I discovered that while we're funding this bomb-sniffing elephant research, it actually takes place in South Africa, where in Namibia and Angola, due to another U.S.-funded wars in the 1980s, fighters for freedom left landmines everywhere after both sides lost. Rather than just running a traditional goat lottery over the fields to clear them, turns out the I'm sorry, I was having a report of no sound, but apparently we're okay. In any case. Anyway, allowing a train of thought to proceed this way is truly nutty, I suppose, but the fact that 20 years ago I would never have thought government capable of pursuing such silliness, today I not only believe it's possible for government to take such insanity and run with it, but I have little doubt that in some unknown corner at the end of some interminable hallway in some massive building in D.C., someone's actually developing a plan. Who knows for sure? What we can conclude from the Drudge headlines today and any other day is that Washington, D.C., the whole mess of dictatorial money-printing, warmongering, bread and circuses madness is building palatial barges on Lake Nemi, ships designed for government excess and partying, sex rings, drugs, vanity, and murder. And these ships don't sail. The lasting contribution of these barges, like much of what our federal government has constructed in the late 20th and 21st century, survives only as a symbol of a hated, all-consuming state. Like the Lake Nemi barges, they fanciful and frightening creations of Washington, D.C. will be sunk, destroyed, and shattered sooner than anyone expected. That article was written by Karen Kitkowski, and she's a retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. Normally, she would have been here with something just for our show, but since we couldn't reach her, we thought that reading this article would be the next best thing. And we look forward to having Karen back in her regular slot next month. We always enjoy hearing from Karen. Coming up in our next segment, Phil Ferrugio, a review of today's news, and Michael Annis, publisher and poet. Mike, are you back online now? Well, it looks as though I'm going to have to get Mike back. But you can expect him back by the time we come back after the station break. I'd like to remind you, this is the New American Dream radio show. We're broadcasting live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, and they deserve your support. You can find our shows, our archive, at newdream.us. That's http newdream.us. And now, from Port Orange, Florida, with stops at Information Clearinghouse, Dandelion Salad, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and many others, here is Phil Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid!
All right, okay. Good evening, working stiffs, and the wars just keep on coming. Every high school student should be made to read George Orwell's 1984 and then discuss its relevance today. Now, he published it in 1949, 66 years before we currently have more newspeak, government misinformation and embedded media, our own Ministry of Truth, Department of Homeland Security, and of course, Big Brother, NSA, watching our every move. Don't forget how Orwell's Nation of Oceania was engaged in endless wars with enemies, Goldstein with Eurasia, who once were allies and friends. How about those mass hate rallies in Oceania that seem to have inspired our own USA, USA chants and flag-waving ceremonies? You can't watch a sporting event lately without seeing them. The Monday, May 11, 2015, USA Today cover story was a dandy, to say the least. CIA vet, war, far as I can see. They interviewed former CIA director Mike Morrell, and he tells it like the Empire tells him to. Morrell warns us that it is only a matter of time before the jihadist group ISIS is likely to be in a position to direct more elaborate attacks on American soil that could result in mass casualties. He goes on to state, if we don't get ISIS under control, we're going to see that kind of attack. Morrell should know about wars and attack. He was by Junior Bush's side at the Sarasota Elementary School on 9/11, and along with all Secret Service and other Bush hangers-on, did nothing to rush Bush Jr. the hell out of there when the news came of the second plane hitting the Twin Tower. No, Mr. CIA Morrell allowed Jr. to sit for many minutes more, even though we were, quote, under attack. Why worry when those of us who knew better knew that Jr. was safe as a baby in that classroom? The article goes on to state how this brave warrior, Morrell, was at Obama's side when word was first relayed that a Navy SEAL team had killed bin Laden. Of course, now we who knew better now know that the whole episode was as fishy as a New England chowder. Cy Hirsch just verified that bed of information and lies. Oh, Mike Morrell is quite a guy, a real man's man. After all, he went right from an MA in economics from Georgetown University in 1980 into that great watchdog and junkyard dog agency of our empire. Morrell never had to walk the hot desert sands in 91 or any hot spots without bodyguards present for that matter. Did he really give a rat's ass when our 2003 shock and awe illegal invasion destroyed the entire infrastructure of Iraq? Did he care when citizens there had no air conditioning and 110 plus degree heat and little or no drinkable water? One wonders if Morrell saw the countless photos of what our smart bombs and depleted uranium shells did to thousands of mangled for life little children, all based on lies. Tell me, please. What in the hell does an MA in economics have to do with being a spook anyway? Because that is what Morrell was. Now, after 33 years as a paid servant of this military-industrial empire, Morrell, like all the Bush gang, became an author. His book is aptly entitled The Great War of Our Time, The CIA's Fight Against Terrorism from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. He now warns us that, quote, it was a mistake to think that Al-Qaeda died along with bin Laden. So there you have it. Once again, to justify increasing the already obscene levels of military spending, we have Morrell and all the other hacks from our Congress and mainstream media playing the infamous fear card. Perhaps if we really wanted to get rid of this threat from ISIS and other loony groups of religious warriors, we might consider, A, that we had no business ever going military into the Middle East at all, and our illegal invasions and occupations only fuel the anger and wrath of our victims. B, that we do not need more than 1,000 military bases in more than 100 different countries. And C, that we all need to curb the crap about how America being a Christian nation, the jihadists similar rhetoric about Islam, and the Israelis about Judaism. Enough of the garbage of who are the chosen people. Enough. Our cities crumble both economically and physically, and more of us working stiffs are struggling to make ends meet. Folks, wake up. The enemy is not just those crazies in the Middle East that our shock and awe campaign helped ISIS to recruit. No, the real enemy is greed and the quest for total dominance that, sadly, our empire is guilty of, as all the political and business leaders of all the nations of this tired and beaten down planet. Thank you.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon commuted the life sentence of a 61-year-old man who had been jailed for 2 decades for marijuana offenses. The governor's action makes Jeff Mazansky eligible for parole, an option he didn't have under the terms of his life sentence. Mazansky was sentenced as a prior and persistent drug offender under Missouri's three strikes law, which was repealed last year. The executive power to grant clemency is one I take with a great deal of consideration and seriousness, Nixon said in a statement announcing the commutation of Mazansky, as well as the pardoning of 5 other nonviolent offenders. In the case of the commutation, my action provides Jeff Mazansky with the opportunity to demonstrate that he deserves parole, Governor Nixon said. All 3 of Mazansky's offenses involved marijuana. He was given a life sentence after a conviction for attempting to sell about 6 pounds of pot in a 1993 police sting operation.
Maurice Walensky, widow of slain Charlie Hebdo cartoonist George Walensky, has gone public with her doubts about the official version of the killing of her husband, who was widely considered the most talented and accomplished, and least obnoxious, of the magazine's contributors. In the Le Dauphine interview, Maurice Walensky expressed grief and anger, as well as a determination to pursue the truth. Should anything happen to her, God forbid, the French people would have yet another indication that elements of their own intelligence services, in collaboration with Israeli intelligence, orchestrated the Charlie Hebdo and Kosher Deli shootings. Police investigator Helric Fredou was suicided for pursuing the truth about Charlie Hebdo. Jean-Marie Le Pen, founder of the National Front Party, had his house set on fire and was beaten up just 1 week after he accused French intelligence of orchestrating the Charlie Hebdo events. An investigative journalist, Hicham Hamza, was hospitalized with a possible case of poisoning after breaking several stories pointing toward the Charlie Hebdo affair being a joint DCCI-Mossad operation. Georges Walensky, Maurice's late husband, was a giant of French cartooning whose work spanned several decades. In the wake of the neocon Zionist takeover of Charlie Hebdo and the magazine's conversion into a pornographic, satanic, Islam-bashing setup for the coming false flag, Walensky resisted neocon pressure and refused to draw pornographic attacks on sacred symbols and personages. Will Maurice Walensky, Hicham Hamza, and other honest French investigators manage to fully expose the Charlie Hebdo false flag and force the prosecution of the guilty parties? As with 9/11, public exposure of the horrible truth would trigger the biggest scandal in national history and strike a huge blow against the psychopathic Operation Gladio crime lords who rule the West through Orwellian deception.
That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck. And so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day, and remember to tip your congressman. Our next guest of the evening is Michael Hannis. Michael Hannis is the executive editor of Howling Dog Press. He comes to us each month from Denver, Colorado. He is a poet, a editor, a publisher, all kinds of good stuff. And we look forward to hearing Michael every month. And Chuck will be getting Michael on the line right now.
Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Hi, Chuck, and hi, Mike. Hey, Mike, I just want to let you know I'm still bent over in the stadium reciting the litany, and it feels, wow, it's so empowering to know I'm doing my civic duty. I have a special segment planned today, birthday tribute to Gregory Greyhawk, a Canadian-American poet. In 1996, I published his collected works, Wailing in Heaven, Whistling in Hell, through Howling Dog Press. Gregory deeply touched, deeply disturbed, and often mentored many other writers. So to begin, I will start with a poem written by poet Jerry Smaldone, a mutual friend, and himself a poet who knew Greyhawk probably as well as anyone. First, a brief bio about Jerry. Jerry Smaldone has been a fixture on the Denver poetry scene for decades as a performance host, reader, and writer of numerous chapbooks. His themes are the mythic cycles that underlie reality and how they change us inside. His subjects are the Italian-American family, local Denver, and what lies beyond the psychic border. He has been published in Exquisite Corpse and Lummox and can be read online at Denver Crossroads. His latest book is titled All Flesh Shall See It Together from Turkey Buzzard Press, and his next, Fado Amano, will soon be available on Amazon. Ghosts by Jerry Smaldone for Gregory Greyhawk. Old ghosts haunt me in the dark, quiet hour, but this time I'm not afraid. Maybe they can show me, take me inside the shadow of the heedless moon, whisper words in my ear, words so much easier than the images I struggle with, live with. Family, job, loved ones, pain and mortality torture my worried sleep, leave me exhausted and sick. Another gone. The crazy Indian who thought he could teach me to write, who gratefully accepted my beat-up Olivetti as he left town, who proudly accepted Father Woody's 20, slept in an abandoned rail car. Shh, it's a secret, lest some other down-and-outer try to invade. Come, he said, let us dance on a grand Denver viaduct under a fat summer moon and howl what our hearts can't speak. Let us pretend the women love us, and maybe they do. Let us sell bullshit and pray the rubes buy it. Let us stay up late plying our muse with smoke and twist the sound into shapes the lady will admire and bless us with a gallon of booze and a good woman with a steady job to keep us safe from the cold, hard night. Let's talk about missing teeth, the sly side of hockey, why Canadian poets are better, PR jobs where I made and blew a fortune. The big scores so close, I could taste them. That's why I'm living in a boxcar next to the river with an alley cat singing to me as I cross the deserted railroad tracks. Here, kitty, kitty, you are the best friend I have. What a team we make, singing to the stars that should never be named. Greyhawk, remember, to forget that name that you ever met me. If anyone asks, you don't know me. I'm a shadow who passed through Denver on the way to another ship, sailing from the coast on an opium cruise. I'm keeping watch on the stern, where the stone is ultimate awareness as black as home Detroit, and the water is as cold and deep as Lake Superior, and keeps her secrets and her bodies just as well. Let us never abdicate our total freedom, no matter the circumstance. We've forgotten how important it is. Let us be rude and obnoxious and craft the most precise and human poems. Let us spread tobacco to the four directions and drive our hatred into hell, spewing venom at white men, black men, red brothers who robbed this half-breed of all he ever owned, his own piece of reservation heaven, and a blind, drunken curse on God who stole his wife and children in a fiery crash. I can't think of it, staring up into the endless black space. You won't forget me now, will you? How I loved your simple family, how I believed in the kindness of hooded sisters, in the mercy of Jesus, in this Catholic crap. Save that sappy Dago bullshit for some other sucker, somebody who hasn't killed total strangers for a cause he was too young to believe in, someone who hasn't lost it all, foundering so hopelessly that his psyche was submerged in the darkest of oceans, down, down beneath the waves. I am here. Let me speak. Gregory Greyhawk, one of the greatest poets of our time, was of the Huron-Wendat Nation in Canada. Besides working on the assembly lines of Detroit's auto industry, playing professional hockey, serving as an American Marine Corps sniper in Vietnam, and as first mate on ships on the Great Lakes and high seas, he had two master's degrees from Canadian universities and could speak and write four languages, English, French, Latin, and his own native tongue. As a poet, he was very discriminating about his choice of words and ideas to apply to highly select subject matter. He didn't write about small ideas and small themes with small vision. He refused to compose inconsequential verbiage for the sake of publishing what turns out to be socially acceptable mediocrity and social convention. He made two statements that essentially became his lifelong modus operandi. One, that he was never persuaded by convention. And two, when one has written a line that will last for 500 years, then one might claim to have actually accomplished something. His writing was more precious than any employment or political, social, cultural movement, or oftentimes even more than his community interconnectedness, which he would frequently disdain. His poetry embodied all that he knew to be valuable in this life, and he wouldn't do anything to lessen or cheapen it. To wit, he stated in one of his poems, quote, "I don't care if you read my book or not," end quote. You see, it wasn't his loss. Today we are featuring one poem that Gregory wrote and recorded titled Money and Freedom, Freedom and Money. In 1996, I set him up in a studio and had him record nearly all of his work. From that session, I produced his CD titled Orenda. Via that recording, you will now hear him read the poem in his own voice. Money and Freedom, Freedom and Money.
Money and Freedom, Freedom and Money. One, everybody loves freedom. Everybody lusts for money. Freedom has always remained popular, and money persists, the shrewd muse of hope and desire. Anytime, any morning, on the same slick plank to work, you can shape yourself their brightest zealot. Freedom, for the yuppies in China. Freedom for the poor, poor campesinos. Freedom for the starving boggart in Africa. You would bestow freedom to all those who have no appliances, who enjoy no bewildering choices in the drugstore. Yet they do have the freedom to fight, and we all have the freedom to die. But they think they only need more money. That money is beauty, is money is freedom. That money makes beautiful. People are beautiful because they have money. Two. The price tag on money is freedom, and the price tag on freedom is blood. If you place no price tag on your life, then freedom of speech bears some freedom. But you shut your mouths, stunned, every time money walks by. Maybe money will divulge some of its secrets, maybe impart some of its implied promise of freedom. Salvage what little luck you've had. You could have been born hauling rocks for the Pharaoh. Three. Music should be free, and for its simple answers, you can get music almost free on the radio. It will cost only the time you clock between the dirges, your soul, the dog patient for the tin click of the can opener. Sex should be free, but deaf as death to our pleas, it chants mute with no price tag. As with the finer objet d'art, one must negotiate. And love. Love is never free. Like sheep, baby chicks, the backyard city garden, it must be nurtured, protected. One always remembers. One never forgets. So far, what love has cost. Four. All of us always love what we don't own, what we can never have. Listen, Rudolph, before your annual mission to every pitiful palm-open colony, I want to christen your pride with this empty wine bottle song. Want to smash your misaligned nose-light badge and powder your vanity with your blood and its glass. I want you to see now, far more illuminated than Rimbaud, that you should deliver freely sudden contraband guns to all the right, the new engines. Five. I think I'm smart. Think I know. I recognize freedom. I think I've trained a cat to retrieve. When it rains and there's no respectable hunting, I throw an empty, crumpled, crackly ciggy pack across the room to entertain him. I throw him clay pigeons and tricky grounders to third. When he catches his practice prey, he brings it back, tail high, and he knows that I'll throw it again.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida.
Sorry.
Sorry about that, Michael. That was just amazing. I thank you so much, Michael, for bringing Greyhawk to our attention.
Yeah, he was consistently one of the most profound writers and thinkers that I have ever come across in my life. And people who aren't familiar with his work, he said, you know, I don't care if you read my book or not, but, you know, make it a mission. Make it a mission to find his work and read it, because it is absolutely astounding.
Well, that wraps up our segment. Thanks again, Michael, and we look forward to hearing from you again next month. It's always a pleasure.
And now for another episode of Minnesota Ice. It's cold. Sponsored by Minnesota Public Radio, a Prairie Home Companion, Powder Milk Biscuits, Big Walleye Shore Lunch Mix, and Big Blue Ox Bologna in a Big Box. In this week's episode of Minnesota Ice, Minnesota's Democratic Senators Al Franken and A.B. Klobuchar. Paul Wellstone was also a Democratic Senator from Minnesota who opposed war and questioned the official 9/11 story, the man who knew too much. And then there is Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton, who was once U.S. Senator Mark Dayton, Democrat, Minnesota. Back in the days just after 9/11, Dayton nearly broke down crying on the Senate floor as he railed against the grotesque lies told by his own military leadership. Shortly thereafter, Senator Dayton was forced to flee Washington, D.C., along with his entire staff, and returned to Minnesota due to terrorist threats and announced his retirement. His fellow Minnesota Senator and 9/11 skeptic, Paul Wellstone, didn't get the message and was murdered, along with his wife, daughter, and staffers, in a rigged plane crash less than a week after he was issued an apparent death threat by Dick Cheney. Dayton knows the truth about what happened to Paul Wellstone, but says nothing. So do Al Franken and Amy Klobuchar, but they say nothing. We do nothing. We want to live. We like our lives. Please forgive us. Don't hate us because we're rich and powerful and having a pretty good time while others die. Minnesota Ice, it's cold. It's the American dream, and you have to be asleep to believe it. We don't believe it. We don't believe in Barack Obama or the 9/11 Commission or Ronald Reagan or the U.S. military or the Warren Commission. We do believe in folks like Phil Ferruccio, Michael Annis, Karen Kitkowski, and hundreds of others who over decades have pursued the new American dream where the people will know the truth about the history of their own country. And because of this, they will be allowed to pursue not wealth and 900 TV stations and every Jetson gadget imaginable at the cost of the lives of the people of Gaza and Iraq and El Salvador and Afghanistan, but will be allowed to pursue peace, prosperity, and good things through peace. It's an amazing time to be alive. We've survived Kate Smith on the radio the whole month of September 2001. We survived Bush, though not all of us. How many will survive Obama is yet to be seen. It's morning, time to wake up. Your toast is ready. The bus is here. The world is on fire. There are no longer any questions we cannot ask. Nothing about our country we are not allowed to know. We are Americans. This is our country. Today, we take it back. From the CIA, the military, the bosses, the Warren Commission, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, the 9/11 Commission. Our children will study lies no more. Did George W. Bush, his father's friends, actually steal the elections of 2000 and 2004? And if they did that, why would they ever stop at anything? Did George W. Bush, Cheney, Karl Rove, Condoleezza Rice, John Ashcroft, Paul Wolfowitz, Colin Powell conspire to commit murder and treason in the 9/11 attacks in order to, again, be able to lie about anthrax, uranium, and WMD, a torture, in order to attack Iraq and make millions, billions of dollars? We want to know. We need to know. We deserve to know who killed Bobby, Martin, JFK, Wellstone. Did we land on the moon? How about climate change, climate manipulation, Fukushima, and HAARP? Just asking. It's okay to ask. There are no wrong questions, remember? No secrets in anyone's land of the free. How do we explain to our children how the war on drugs goes with this buzz for you? Prisons, poverty, trees, sun power, wind power, we can talk about all of it because we are Americans again. We are not the subjects of the FBI or CIA or the U.S. Army or Wall Street. We do not torture, kill children, bomb, rape, mutilate. We are Americans. We are Americans. Why is Leonard Peltier in prison? Why did we fund death squads in El Salvador? We overthrew elected governments in Chile, Iran, Guatemala. Really? Why? We deserve to know. We need to know. We have to know so that we may tell the world we are Americans. Don't be afraid to be a real American. Remember, they want us to be afraid, as they told us in the anthrax letters. We are not afraid. It is they who are afraid of us, as it should be. Don't be afraid to be a real American. There is a place like no place on earth, a land full of wonder, mystery, and danger. Some say to survive it, you need to be as mad as a hatter. And if you come to understand this mad place, the others will tell you that you are entirely bonkers. But I'll tell you a secret. All the best people are. Remember, they want us to be afraid. We are not afraid. It is they who are afraid of us. That is why they work so hard, have so many big, guarded, expensive buildings full of people working day and night to deceive us. We are that good. And eventually, after a long struggle and many times that we want to quit and many days that we think it will never turn out good, we will win. Can you believe that? That is the new American dream. Well, it's been another long week in Newtown, my hometown at the end of the empire. It is time for the publication of the new sophomore history textbook, the bread and butter of 3B1K Publishing House, managed by Nikostatos Greenberg in Newtown. Seems nobody is paying much attention to history these days. What is he to do? Well, he's running all over the grounds to talk to people to figure things out, for one thing. The radio on the counter crackled and talked about the story in the paper about the murder on the front lawn on 9th Street.
What did they say, said Nick, pointing at the radio with Toast. You got a cover? Nick's wife asked him if she set out the green beans on a red-hot pad. Of course we got a cover. Nick brushed the heads of three children on his way to the door on the front porch. He paused at the top step, as he always did, to see that the smoke of the factory was straight, the correct color, the correct volume, ever since the fire of 1975. He stood with his father right there on the steps, holding their fishing poles, checking the smokestacks, looking for black, not the boring whites, no wind. Same old thing. Nick remembered the glorious black smoke, like tires burning, and the smell, like old tomato soup, and how his father handed him his pole and ran as if people were on fire, which they were. To his father, the people living inside those precious history books, he recalled his own thoughts. Burn it down and go fishing. Get up on the big grader and drive the grader himself and push the rubble back to make room on the shore. Nick opened the glass door of the cover design office, not without trepidation. He eased himself inside with one long silent step and another quick 1-2. He saw the blonde back of Lori Groom's head. Imagine kissing it. Groom, the art department head, as she stared at a computer screen in the middle of a horseshoe of computers with all sizes of screens, the chairs vacated in various modes of escape, stealthy to fast. The walls were decorated in sophomoric history book art, some award plaques, a few newspaper clippings memorialized behind glass. He got closer, saw how intent she was in a reflection in her screen. She mumbled, moved her nose closer to the glass. She was impressive in looks and intensity. If he wasn't married, well, if he was 100 years younger, a foot taller, if he'd shaved today, this week, who knows? Nick tiptoed around a chair and purse. He was close. If he was an assassin, he would have her or spare her. He was that smucking goddamn close. Stood behind her and heard the Chinese menu mumbling. She clicked, fumbled in her purse at her feet for her card, returned the card, stopped in motion, looked back at him, and, yes, she said, annoyed. The Easter Bunny, he said. She saw it was him. Turned back to her computer, clicked on white plastic spork rather than chopsticks. Nick sat in a gray padded chair on wheels, three spots down the line. He hummed the tune from the radio news show as he touched the personal items on the desk in front of him, as if deciding whether to buy. He covered the robin's egg blue mouse with his hand, hiding it. He moved it back and forth, sideways, trying to make the cursor on the screen go where he wanted. So, Nicky, what's up? Can you show me the cover? I mean, I know what it is, I know, but can we talk about it? She turned toward him. As in, just put it on your screen, you know, however you... He kicked two chairs out of the way, dragged himself up to her. She turned to her screen. Their knees touched. Oh, sorry, she said. There it was. American History 101, Triumph of the American Nation. How many times we use that, he said, putting a fat finger on the screen. Been a while, she said. Why? He shook his head, said nothing. He looked intently at the front cover, the square photos of Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, a teacher's desk, a flag, an artsy foggy apple on the desk. What are the options, he said. Well, we've got Andrew Jackson, but nobody knows who he is. Lewis and Clark, maybe Sacagawea, you know. But that's just asking for trouble. She's pointing at something, but what exactly? Right, said Nick. You're right. We don't need no trouble. He pushed away from the desk with his hands and his feet in the air as if it were an Olympic sport now. We might need to do something, he said. Change it up a bit, you know. She swiveled to watch him. She stood, hands on hips, mouth open. He could see her in the door glass. What? He heard her. Just as the door closed. Nick scuffled on the sidewalk by the street, paralleling the river on the far side of the campus and the stream of cars running right next to him. The subtitle bunker had been his great-grandfather's big deal. In the spirit of the Cold War and personal bunkers in suburban homes being the thing, he'd come up with the idea of making the subtitle of the sophomore history book top secret, hoping to increase its import by secrecy and showboating. Nicostatus Greenberg number one had sat in the Garamond bar downtown and written it all out on a napkin, as the legend went, as written by himself. He decided that the unveiling of the sophomore history textbook subtitle would be Top Secret, developed and hidden and protected and launched from a bunker in the middle of the giant lawn on the campus. And because it was a big secret, it would be a big deal. And the big deal would be connected right to the pageant, the local book launch and the national coverage, just like they paraded the goddamn gopher in his shadow. They would cover the new national sophomore history textbook to be placed in every classroom in America. It worked pretty good at times, till now. Now the whole goddamn shebang had fallen apart on Nick's watch. There was no way to get to the subtitle bunker. The idea that management liked to put out, even though everyone knew it was bullcrap, was that if you were ready to enter the subtitle bunker, it would make itself available to you. Kind of like the waitresses at the Times New Roman when a kid turned 21. Unless you had a smucking key. Nick headed out over the lawn, angling toward the launch site. He found the red key fairly easily on his Captain Kangaroo ring on his belt. Unlocked the padlock, pushed the gate open just far enough, locked the lock. He walked over the rocky, bumpy lawn. It didn't get the care the rest of the rolling lawns received, as some of the commanders in the bunker were reluctant to allow the grounds crew access. Nick heard the cameras focusing, whirring, swiveling, following him. He slid his hand down the railing and trotted down the cement, sometimes like a team into a locker room under the field. He sometimes imagined, not today. Today he had other crap on his mind. He opened the heavy gray door that should have been locked. Nick stepped into the concrete block room, large, dark, lit by three rows of computer screens. He heard the ball game on a radio somewhere. He clomped down an empty aisle, grabbing half a sandwich from a keyboard around an empty chair obstacle course. Cigarettes smoked alone in orange and green glass ashtrays. There they all were, eating sandwiches and smoking inside the launch room. Nick smiled, shook his head, and entered another gray door into the glassed room where everyone gathered around. Two men playing chess on their computer screens. The two computers sat just far enough away from each other that one man could not operate both. The fail-safe launch method had started out as a lark, but now was factual. This glass room had its own oxygen, water, septic, security system, with real cyanide pills and 45 pistols to kill the other guy if you think he's gone mad. Nick waved his hand at the smoke. One guy took dollar bill bets in the corner. They all watched in silence as the two men at the computers, strapped in by shoulder harnesses on the launch chairs, did battle. Nick handed the man three thin bills and nodded at the guy on the right. He sat on the metal windowsill and put his feet up on the black steel launch code box marked IBID. He waited until one guy won. And the guy in the corner started taking and handing out money. Nick joined the line and heading out the door. It was hot in there. He wiped sweat off his forehead with the wet back of his hairy hand. He waited for Dino, one of the chess combatants. They walked into the first glassed office on the left, leaving the door open. Dino sat at the desk. Nick stood, then sat in the one chair, then stood. I should know better and bet against you, said Nick. What's up, boss, said Dino. What you got for this year, said Nick. I thought you knew, said Dino. Well, I did. Just tell me again, huh? Dino worked his computer. Nick looked around the office at the plaques commemorating the subtitles of past years. The American Pageant. Triumph of the American Nation, misspelled. What a smucking deal that was. The Great Republic. Land of Promise. Oh, yeah. Here you go. Dino swiveled the screen so Nick could see. Nick looked quick. Yep. When do you launch, he said. When's the pageant, asked Dino. I got to talk to her about that, said Nick. Well, said Dino, leaning back in his chair, putting his feet on his desk, getting ready for something coming. It would be about a week before that. Give us some time to boot up, all that. You know how it goes. Oh, said Dino. Putting his feet down, picking up two baseball gloves from his desk. He tossed one to Nick. It's just a thing, said Dino, but, well, you know how it goes. Dino put the glove up around his face to talk, as did Nick. Yeah, I know, he said through the webbing of the club. can't be too careful, said Dino. Huh? Oh, yeah, yeah. You're right there. Nick liked the smell of the glove, the leather like summer. He and his father had talked through the gloves when they sat on the porch step sometimes. His father didn't want any competitor driving past and getting an advantage. And then he made the launch team use them whenever anyone talked to anyone else in the bunker because you never knew who was a spy and who wasn't, you know. We might have to, began Nick. He reached out, kicked the door closed, keeping the glove at his face. Looking over the top of the fingers at Dino, who sat again with his feet on the desk, making his expensive smucking chair lean way back, holding the glove to his face with his right hand, even though it was the wrong hand, and trying to work his computer mouse with the other. It wasn't easy. Change things up a little bit, said Nick. What's that, said Dino, not really looking at Nick. Nick leaned forward in his chair. We need a new fucking subtitle, craphead. You hear me now? Dino slowly finished what he was doing and took his time looking back at Nick, who'd sat back in his chair, his face and neck blazing, his eyes glaring wide as full moons with spy cameras and eyebrows on full smucking focus. Why is that? Said Dino. It's all set. Same Saturday in May or June, usually, unless someone has a hair thing and has to change the launch date. He slammed his boots to the cement. I don't know, said Nick. Something different, that's all. So I know something different. Dino reached inside a drawer, pulled out a manila file, opened it, slid one sheet away where Nick couldn't see it, and handed the next one to Nick. There's some possibles, said Dino. All right, said Nick, beginning to take a look. He scanned down the page with the heading possibles. Hard-working Americans. White picket fences. What's for dinner? What is your favorite color? If you were a tree, if you were a lunch bucket. What's that crap, he said. What for dinner? If you were a lunch bucket, are you smucking kidding me? He let the glove sit on his seat as he got up. He accepted a stick of gum from Dino and turned toward the door. We need to change them, said Nick. It, change it, said Dino, grabbing his glove again quick, not quite getting into his face in time. I don't know what, said Nick, inching out the door. I'll tell you what, just as soon as I know what, okay? He stuck his nose inside the door just as it closed. Yeah, okay, said Dino, pressing his nose flat into the pocket of the glove that smelled like summer and grass and sun and glove oil and plenty of good stuff.
That's the news from Newtown, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. Once again, we thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week, right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Visit our archives at newdream.us. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
And thanks to our guests, Phil Ferruccio, Michael Hannes, Karen Kitkowski, and Julius Alifong. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to theshow.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artisan Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sir Hans Rahan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at looserock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrubyridge.com. To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave Handy Campfire Rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-sized Obamaville Tom Jefferson Rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And so good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Mohammed Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.